Access Cast, an Accessibility initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibility and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibility. That's ACCESSIBE. Visit www.accessibility.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Welcome to another edition of Unstoppable Mindset. Thank you for being here. Hope that your week is going well, and we hope that you enjoy the podcast today. Our guest is Davida Shimsky, and she has an interesting story to tell. And I like talking with her because we share some interesting and similar ideas about dealing with disabilities and so on. Davida happens to be a person who we classify as someone with a disability, and I'm going to let her tell you more about that as we go forward. But Davida, welcome to Unstoppable Mindset. How are you?
I'm doing great, and thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on, and we're honored that you're here and taking the time with us. So tell me a little bit about you, if you would. Let's start with that.
Okay. Well, I grew up with a disability, and Well, first, let me back up. I was born in 1951, and in 1951, there were no laws that addressed people with disabilities, and society looked at its disability community as being non-existent. And it was prior to the laws of when the Individual Disability Education Act came into existence, because that came into existence in 1977 when I was in graduate school, and I'd already been in the workforce a few years before the Americans with Disabilities Act became law. And because society didn't recognize its disability community, and the fact that I came from a dysfunctional family to begin with, I was always told that I can't. And part of that was that you would think it's because my parents were worried about me, but it was more that they had their own issues about it. And all they saw was a way to hold their children back from living full and productive lives.
So they weren't necessarily the most supportive?
No. Not at all.
Now, you say hold their children back. You have siblings with disabilities?
I have an older sister that was born deaf, and hers is a nerve deafness, and it's a specific syndrome that I cannot remember the name of it offhand, but it's a segment of people that are born deaf, and it's called a syndrome, because it's not a fully, the total numbers aren't there for it to be called whatever it is, you know? So it's just lumped in to being deaf.
Yeah.
Just like I have spastic hemiplegia, because cerebral palsy only affects one side of the body as opposed to the whole body or certain other limbs, because if it depends on how much of the brain is damaged and what specific limbs are affected to determine what the terminology is for it.
So how was it between you and your sister growing up?
Well, it was kind of mixed because she was always sent off to school initially because my mother was from New York and they had Lexington School for the Deaf up there where she could go to school and stay there during the week and then go home on weekends. Mm-hmm. And when she went home on weekends, she either stayed with my grandmother or one of my aunts and uncles. And she never really had a stable home that she went to. And that created some issues for her. And in my case, because I was the only person with a disability in the classroom and in the school, and people didn't know a whole lot about disabilities, I was bullied. And it's like when you go home and you don't have any parents to hug you and tell you they love you, then it's like you being isolated and trying to cope with things on your own.
Yeah. Well, just to put it in perspective, I was born in 1950, so I was from the same era as both of you and fully understand what you have said about all of the issues regarding the laws. But for you, it was probably quite the challenge. Do you use and did you use a wheelchair?
No, because it only affects my right side. Initially, I wore the brace. It was only up to the knee because the way it affects it is that the tendon in the foot is very tight. And I either go flat foot or I walk toe heel as opposed to heel toe and drag my foot. And then I would catch my toe or the shoe of the toe would catch the ground and it would cause me to fall over. So wearing, and they were the old iron braces. And then in 1980, as the health club started to come into existence and an understanding of how exercise and strengthening and straightening and could help, well, when I turned 14, I had surgery on both my hand and my foot because my hand was very drawn up and I could not really just pull it down to my side. And then it kind of moved down to a 90-degree angle or maybe a 60-degree angle. And by exercising, it gave me a little bit more mobility, and it allowed me to not have to put the brace back on. But when I turned 65 and I noticed that I was tripping over my own 2 feet and living alone, and if I fell and hurt myself, there would not be anyone there. Then I started wearing a walk-on brace. And I also have a brace on my hand that supports my wrist, so it holds it up, so the wrist doesn't curl up. And recently, I had a knee brace put on because years ago after the surgery, my orthopedist said I had caught football knees because there was no fluid around the knee, and then the bone was rubbing against each other. And over the years, it slowly got a little worse. And then the last couple of times, I noticed that when my knee started hurting me, I couldn't put pressure on my foot. And because the way health insurance is, as you become a senior citizen, they called me, now I see you, they called me and to the nurse and anyway, they said, go see an orthopedist. So I had to go to my doctor. And what he did was he sent me to the orthopedist. The orthopedist said, you need a sleeve. And then when I went to the prosthetics place, they said, no, this is what you need. And one thing I found was by putting the knee brace on, it's repositioning my foot. I'm able to walk better and continue to exercise 3 times a week.
So how was it like?
It helps with everything. Oh,
go ahead. Go ahead. How was it like for you in the classroom in grammar school and high school and so on?
Well, because cerebral palsy affects how the brain processes information, what happened was it got into short-term memory, and even though I would study for hours, it didn't always show when I took a test what I was truly capable of. So based on my grades, it was like, oh, she daydreams a lot. Oh, you know, she's, you know, it was more like C or D as opposed to what could have been an A or a B. And you know, back then, they kind of like labeled you according to your grades.
Well, yeah. And how did your classmates react, or how did they deal with you?
Bullied. I was teased a lot. They kind of played on my name and how they said it. Let's back up. I once had someone call me and ask me out for a date. And something told me they were not going to show. But you never know for certain, so you get ready. But I never expected it. And of course, they didn't show.
Yeah.
So they were playing, they got together and they said, oh, let's see what we can do to play a game on it.
There's a lot of meanness in kids. And do you think, you know, given what you do now, and I definitely want to get into that, but do you think that's changed a lot for kids with disabilities in school today?
It's changed some, but it's still got a long way to go. And the thing is that because of IDEA, which is Individual Disability Education Act, and it's mainstreaming kids into the classroom when they're capable of keeping up, that people with abilities are seeing more people with disabilities, so they're a lot more accepting than what they were in the past, because people with disabilities and severe disabilities were hidden away.
Yeah.
And they just didn't know that they existed, and it was not talked about.
Do you think that kids in the classroom take that approach, or are they more still into the bullying mentality? Do you think they are starting to understand the difference, and that in reality, there's nothing wrong with someone just because they happen to be different?
I believe there is, because when you see a whole group of people that have specific disabilities, then it's easier to accept than if you just see one or two people.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, I've got one person, they are different. I have no, you know, the ignorance of what a disability was at that time, because it was not talked about. Today it's talked about, and you see the Paralympics, and you see people who have lost limbs in the war, whatever. So it's a little bit more accepting, although it's still got a long way to go to become mainstream.
Yeah. I know in the case of blind kids, for example, we see so little emphasis on doing some of the things that really make sense. That is, for example, teaching Braille, which is the main vehicle for reading and writing available to blind kids, not only totally blind kids, but a lot of children who are partially blind, who are low vision, but who cannot see well enough to read regular print. And by using large print or magnified print, it causes a lot of eye strain, so they'll never be able to read as quickly or as efficiently as a sighted person or a blind student that does get the opportunity to learn to read Braille. But unfortunately, I think still even today in the educational system, it is always, or let me not say always, it is often basically said that a child who has some eyesight gets to read print, while a totally blind child has to learn to read Braille. And you can see the distinction, gets to as opposed to has to, even though the child who reads Braille
may very well be a much better reader than someone who has some vision, who doesn't get the opportunity to learn to use Braille, and as a result has to use large print that doesn't give them all the luxury and efficiency of truly having a reading and writing language that they can use well.
You know, even when in technology, when people look to build websites today, they don't always think about accessibility.
They don't. And in fact, hence the company that I work for, Accessibee, which is all about creating products to help websites become accessible for a variety of disabilities. And it is very much true that website access isn't just something that is relating to a person who is blind and might not be able to see graphics and so on the internet. There are so many disabilities that need to be addressed, not being able to use a mouse for a variety of reasons, or having epilepsy and as a result not being able to experience cursors that blink and need a different way to make that happen, or cognitive disabilities or ADHD. All of those are issues that invoke a need for access that oftentimes we don't pay attention to.
And I part of that, I think, is that until people with disabilities, more people with disabilities actually have their own business or become managers and business owners where they're more visible, it's still going to be kind of a situation where it's a secondary idea to the majority of people. It's like when it becomes, I guess the best way is to equate it with Christianity and Judaism, that we live in a country where it's more Christians than Jews, and yet, especially in the Baptist religion, it's like they consider Catholics and Protestants that, you know, kind of like not being, I don't want to say non-Christians, because of the doctrines or the ways they look at it.
But I think it goes beyond us owning our own businesses, because that may or may not make some of it more visible. We really need to create an environment that's more inclusive in general. The fact is that there are some who say, and rightly so, let's deal with access, that the only way to make a website accessible, or the best way, some say the only way, which is not true, but the best way to make a website accessible is to really do it from the outset. And I can accept that concept, except how's that working for us? We don't generally see websites as being accessible from the outset. In fact, probably no more than about 2% of all websites today even pay much attention to accessibility, no matter what the disability. Some websites may very well be usable, but they haven't really done all that or anything that they need to do to create access. So we have an environment where we don't create web accessibility from the outset. And that's something that we have to teach and that needs to go into our schools and that all of our programmers need. But even if we do it, we then need to make sure that websites continue to remain accessible. It isn't just doing it the first time.
That's true. And I'm also going to go back and say that even a lot of the laws started changing, like with the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, it addresses all of the issues that come up under the Americans with Disabilities Act. But what makes the ADA more enforceable is that clause that says that if an individual can prove that they're being discriminated against, they can go to the EEOC or they can go to the Department of Justice and file a lawsuit.
The difficulty is that courts have also said, however, you got to prove intent, right? And that has been part of the difficulty. And the other part is that some legal minds have challenged the issue of accessibility, let's say for the internet, saying, well, the ADA came along before the internet, so clearly it doesn't apply, even though the ADA does not in any way mention places of physical accommodation. It talks about places of business, leaving aside Title II, which deals with the government and federal agencies. Title III deals with places of business, and it doesn't say physical or not, which is the way it ought to be, because it doesn't matter where you conduct business. You need to make sure that what you do is available to all.
That's true. We also need to look at the mentality or behavior patterns, because what we learn as children is how we are as adults. And until you really get to where children come up truly integrated with people with disabilities in the classroom, they're still going to be prejudiced.
Sure. And until we can break down that fear barrier, because that's what it really is that people have so much fear around something that's different than they. And they don't recognize that in reality, disability is something that anyone can face suddenly, even if your life didn't start out being that way. And again, I don't have a better term than disability, but the reality is disability doesn't and shouldn't mean, in our case, no ability or a lack of ability. It is a way to categorize us, like it or not, as being different. But it shouldn't mean that we don't have ability, because if we're going to talk about ability, every person who has eyesight has a disability, and that is that you're light dependent. You can't function well in the dark. That's why we have light bulbs. That's why we have candles. And before that, we had torches and other things like that. But the reality is, those are all accommodations that have been created to allow you to be able to function in an environment without light.
And then if you remember, prior to ADA, because ADA was when they started changing the terminology, that it was always handicapped. And if you remember back in the very beginning of the 20th century, when people used to stand with their cap in hand, asking for money, and that's what handicap means, and it's still the mentality of the majority of people is that someone getting a handout.
Yeah. And in reality, we can change perceptions of words. Words are very strong and very powerful, but I, for example, have maintained for a long time that diversity isn't what it used to be. Diversity very rarely includes disabilities today. Even though what diversity means is we have a very wide range of categories of people that exist, and we're supposed to recognize all of them, but we generally don't include disabilities in that. And it's the same fear that causes that. So we haven't really seen the breakdown in terms of moving forward with that. And I'm not sure what it will take to change that, but maybe what we need to do is to get another president who has a disability. Franklin Roosevelt has been forgotten for that.
Well, that's right. Also, if you back in the 1980s, when corporations started bringing in trainers and they would talk about diversity, they would not include disability, but what they would talk about is the different cultures or the different mm-hmm. religions, but mm-hmm. they never talked about difference in showing someone with a disability as opposed to someone with ability, and showing just because you're able-bodied doesn't mean that you're really any different.
Or any better.
Yeah.
And that is what hopefully people will get to understand. Well, tell me, what degrees do you have? So you went on through high school and you went to college and did all sorts of stuff like that. And
yeah, I have an associate's in mental health. I have credits. I have a bachelor's in psychology. And then I also have credits towards a master's in rehabilitation counseling. Not that I wanted to become a rehabilitation counselor, as that I wanted to learn about the laws. And then I went on and got certification in psychodrama. I'm certified in using transactional analysis. And both of those modalities are now basically repackaged under the laws of attraction. And I'm certified as a law of attraction coach, as well as a career coach and a life coach.
And the law of attraction in some ways has certainly become a very popular concept on the internet. And I think in probably the minds of a lot of people, but again, that gets misinterpreted too.
I actually had someone send me an email that it's a company called Bok.com and it's out of the UK. And they sent me an email, oh, we have clients that need your services. Really and truly, the way they're set up and what they did was they sent me a copy of a lead, but they don't get people to call in and tell them what their needs are. They just ask them a few basic questions, like, are you looking for a life? What kind of coach are you looking for? Or what kind of issues do you want to deal with? And then they give you a 1 in 5 chance to bid on a lead. And now you can register for free. Then you can upgrade for a monthly fee to become an elite pro, which they all they do is put some type of badge on your profile. But you have to buy credits to be able to approach these leads that they send you. And when you upgrade for the first batch, what they do is they don't let you know up front, well, if you don't make any sales, you get those credits back. But if once you start getting low, they will automatically add more credits and charge your checking account. Now, when I started looking at them, the majority of those leads were people that had anger management, or they were looking to have insurance pay for the services. Well, if you're just a certified life coach and you do not have licensure as a psychotherapist, insurance companies will not pay for your services. Mm-hmm. And I went, actually, before I actually upgraded, I went looking for some reviews and couldn't find any. But then when I went to put a complaint in, all of a sudden I found some reviews. And there was someone in there that said that what she found was that, and I'm assuming she kept probably buying more and more credits because she said she had to keep lowering her fees just because no one would purchase it and still never got a sale. So what that means is that particular company is more about putting money in their pocket as opposed to really being a lead generation company for people who need services.
There are a lot of those in the world, whether it's dealing with what you're talking about or in so many areas.
Mental illness and mental health issues is still a disability issue. So that's also another avenue because mental illness is something that's a hidden disability. It's not something that you can really see other than in someone's behavior. But there can be people whose behavior is not the best, but they're not truly mentally ill. They just have some issues or personal issues they got to deal with based on the environment and the family they grew up in.
when you went into the workforce, what did you specifically join the workforce to do?
Actually, because my background was in mental health and psychology, I applied to the merit system in Georgia, and I qualified for positions that was, God, if you remember the title, but it was more of a social work position. Oh, it was Human Services Technician Senior was the title. And then there was also Mental Health Counselor. But because I wanted to work with disability agencies, the first company that I got hired on with was a company that was really a daycare center for people with developmental disabilities at the time. But once the laws began to change and the state came in and took over those agencies, what happened was that the woman that was running it, that became the executive director, she was just what happened was she did not have the true qualifications to be an executive director. So her people that came in my position, if they weren't forced out within the first 6 months and they got, you know, their permanent status, then automatically they would start going back on the roster to get another position somewhere else because she couldn't, or she felt threatened by those in that position. And when my 6 month probationary period was coming up, she basically said to me, if you don't resign, you're going to be fired. And so, and then after that, I could never get back on with the state. And my only other alternative was, and I would have eventually done this anyway, but I would have waited till I was more financially secure. And I found that I wanted to run groups using transactional analysis and psychodrama, but whereas they were more acceptable up in the North, they weren't as acceptable or known modalities in the South. And because I didn't have that actual master's or PhD as a psychotherapist, I couldn't get in with the hospitals, the mental health hospitals. And then it eventually evolved into the speaking industry and got more involved with National Speakers Association, Georgia chapter, and Toastmasters. And because I didn't have as much mobility and didn't have the transportation to get around as easily, my business never quite got off the ground. But once the technology evolved with being able to build a business online, it's really taken off. And how it's taken off is that I've shifted from going into companies doing the training, but creating the e-learning courses and putting them on various platforms. And one of the companies that I'm with is called One Education or Educators. And I got a nice little surprise from them in that I got a nice paycheck this month. And they also sent me an email that they've partnered with a company called eLearning Solutions. So that may have been why my paycheck for my courses increased astronomically. Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that all too often, no matter how much in the way of qualifications you actually had, because you didn't have that PhD that tended to limit you. Do you think that's as true today, or do people now more recognize that there are other kinds of things, including experience and so on, that should open up opportunities for you?
I think the experience, as much as anything, opens up the opportunities. But also, it's like what I've been able to do is, because of my background in mental health and psychology and my background in rehabilitation counseling, which is career counseling, that I've been able to do more in the line of the life coaching and the career coaching, and then getting the certifications for those particular industries. And then it's just a matter of like, how am I going to sell myself to my potential clients?
Right. So when did you enter the workforce? What year?
Actually, 1977.
Okay. So, so there you go. And when you entered, did leaving aside things like what you described about the director of that agency and so on, did you face much real discrimination from a disability standpoint when you started? And again, how has that changed over the years?
Very much so, because even once I lost my job with the state, I could never get back on with the state. And even though I would be applying to positions within corporations or small businesses, and even though you had the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, there were a lot of things that, you know, they just didn't hire people with disabilities. And when the laws changed and ADA came in, and you had what was then known as the DIB tax, which is the disability business technical assistance centers, DIB tax, right? So now they're called the ADA centers. But they are really just the support system to see to it that what the corporations need. And even though it took ADA before companies were willing to start looking at people with disabilities as, even, you know, and doing the adaptation in the workplace, so that, you know, but having to comply with ADA. Mm-hmm. So it was a more of an opening, not until the early 2000s or the late 1990s, before corporations and companies really started looking at hiring people with disabilities. And one of the things is, if you went to the rehabilitation services, if you went to their employment specialist, their employment specialist really didn't know how to serve the disability community in getting jobs, other than telling them things like, I have these job coach positions. Now, here's the book. Go in and find a company that's going to let you come in and train other people. And it was more of going into the restaurants and teaching people with developmental disabilities to bus tables. You know, it was the low paying, low skilled jobs that were really open, and not the mainstream companies like IBM or Coke that were really open to hiring people with disabilities.
I should have asked, when you were presented with that offer to resign or get fired, what choice did you make?
Well, I ended up deciding if I was going to just to resign, it was better to just resign instead of force a hand, because either way, it still meant the same thing.
So the reason I asked that question was, the difference is that technically speaking, the way you described it, if you were fired, you couldn't get back in to a state position because you've been fired and you have to accept all the consequences of that, such as they are. But if you resigned, and correct me if I'm wrong, technically speaking, you should have been able to obtain other positions within the state, correct?
Yes. But here's the thing. When they would go and get reviews, remember that she became an ex-employer, so they would go to her and say, what kind of employee is she? And guess what? She didn't give me a good review. And also, when you work within the state merit system, it's usually like, I don't think she really wanted to hire me to begin with, but because I was that next hire on that list, she had to give me the position.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also how it works within the merit system. So even though I might have been interviewed in these mental health centers where I would have gone in and done counseling, as opposed to, you know, just being a like a in a social work position where I would represent the clients and go to meetings and make sure that they got the services they deserved, I was never able to get back in to the state.
Did that ever change for you?
No. I mean, once I kept, let's put it this way, rehabilitation services, employment, their employment specialists should have been able to say, hey, I've got contacts within these companies. I'm looking at your background. I can, you know, I can send you out for interviews. They should have been able to do that. He never said that to me.
Yeah. Which all too often happens in the rehabilitation, the rehabilitation environment. And it is so unfortunate. We had the opportunity to, in an earlier podcast episode, interview Kirk Adams, who is the president and CEO of the Lighthouse for the Blind. And he made the comment that there was a meeting where both rehabilitation counselors and HR people were present. And the HR people constantly said it was the rehabilitation counselors that never really did the research or understood what needed to be done to bring people with disabilities in. And the rehabilitation counselors always said that the HR people were the stumbling blocks. So, you know, ne'er the twain seemed to be able to meet.
I think all they were doing was passing along the blame, especially because, first of all, your rehabilitation services people and your HR people should have been working together to help each other understand. They should have been educating each other. What's the job? What are the skills needed? And how can your client fit into this? It's like many, many years ago, my sister, who's deaf, went through rehabilitation services in New York to get a job. And what did they do? They sent her on a job where she needed to answer the phone. Now, how could someone who's deaf answer the phone? And the thing was, back then, she was actually trained to use DOS. And DOS is just programming software. Right. There's no, and people who were deaf were easily placed in jobs, and yet she was not getting the right kind of job for her.
Yeah. And that's, of course, the disconnect, right? Where is the logic in doing that? And there is none. I mean, so it's a rhetorical question, but there really is none. So for you, how long did you keep trying to get into state opportunities? And then what did you do since you weren't able to get in?
That's what I did was I looked at my education, I looked at my experience, I looked at where my skills lied, and that's when I said, okay, let me see if I can start my own business using my training in transactional analysis and psychodrama to run groups, and went to the mental health hospitals and the mental health centers. And because I didn't have that PhD, they were not going to refer business to me. Now, I do have a friend that was living in California that was a licensed family and marriage therapist. And a lot of her referrals came from the insurance companies. And notoriously, they were slow to pay.
Yeah. So what did you do?
That's what I'm saying. Insurance companies, if the client even in Hawk.com is sitting there saying, well, my insurance is going to pay, even if they end up hiring you, insurance may only pay you every 3 months and pay you back pay. But what do you do in that 3 months that they're not paying you?
Right. So what did you do if you weren't getting the referrals
and
so on?
That's when I looked at the fact that I came across a company at the time that was called Performax, which was assessment profiles. and to become a distributor with them and train in how to use the DISC and other assessment profiles like leadership profile, the listening profile, the values profile, and taking those in. Also, a company called Personal Dynamics Institute that had the fully training packages, and go into companies as a trainer. And that's also training as a speaker and getting up in front of groups. And also went to try to work with companies like success seminars. But because I don't make good eye contact, and because when I speak, it's not as smoothly or whatever, I couldn't always get on with those companies. But what I did was I went directly to the associations, and I went directly to the corporations to offer to sell some of my profiles to them and come in and do train-the-trainer sessions.
And how did that work?
I made some money, but it was not as consistent, and it was not as growing because a lot of those companies at the time were built on what's known as multi-level marketing. Yep. So if you, like, there were other people in the industry that knew that I specialized in a certain aspect of it, and instead of referring business to me because I wasn't in their downline and they weren't going to make money off of it, I was never getting those types of referrals either.
So obviously it was kind of a struggle. And I guess the question would be, so then what happened?
Well, it's just slowly. I just started. Then a lot of what I did was knowing that I wanted to start a nonprofit that would serve people with disabilities who wanted to become entrepreneurs. I went to work with a company where it was going door to door, selling them or business to business with specific items to sell them as a fundraiser. And then I worked with a company, and then I went out on my own. And that brought in a lot more consistent income. And then that was also about the time that the internet started to grow and I was able to move everything online. And that's when I started my podcast back in 2007.
So you started basically somewhat of an online business, and you started working with companies going door to door. And what did you eventually do about starting the nonprofit?
I actually got the paperwork and went to LegalZoom to get it started. But then to get the 501c3, I had to pay a certain amount of money or a fee to get the accreditation, and just didn't have that money. And so it kind of all got put on hold and never quite got off the ground either.
Uh-huh.
And then I knew that I needed people in the business industry that would support what I was doing and help me raise the funds. I had one person that was a small business owner, but I never quite got any people in the corporate world to take an interest in the organization. So that kind of, you know, that a lot of those things, it's like people... You'll see people who start nonprofits and they bring their friends on to the board. Well, if you, friends are great, but if they don't know how to help you raise money for your organization and get it out there and get it known, then it's never going to grow.
So what did you do?
So it's kind of still on the back burner with that organization. It's still something I want to do, but I'm thinking more in terms of eventually just setting it up as a foundation that people with disabilities can apply to get funding.
So,
and also I've come across several organizations in Europe that had already gotten off the ground and had connections with financial organizations that would be willing to offer financing to people with disabilities who are starting up a business. So it's the potential is out there, but it's a little bit more difficult to get it up and moving in the United States. And if you look at what's happening in politics today, that's also affecting whether or not a nonprofit that serves the disability community, other than say, if it's for the blind or if it's for people who, I don't want to say autistic or specific, then what happens is they got more people who have children who have those types of disabilities that are coming together and working with them.
So you do a podcast. How often is the podcast on?
My podcast is every Saturday on a weekly basis, and I've been doing it for close to 16 years that way.
Wow. Well, we'll come back to that in a minute. But so what is your main way of generating income? What are you doing primarily in the workforce today, or are you, or what is it you do to help people today?
My main income today is coming through my membership sites, my e-learning courses, and I'm more involved with putting together joint ventures than I have been in the past.
Can you tell me something about some of those, like your courses, your e-learning site, and so on?
Okay. They deal with personal development, things like team building, listening skills, communication skills, body language, listening, and also starting a business as an entrepreneur, being able to use digital marketing, being able to create a website, and just specific areas like that.
And how's that? Is that working out pretty well for you?
It does. It does. And the way I say it also comes into play also. Now, the best way to look at it is if I'm talking about in my business, then what I need to do is look at how specifically they work together. And what's happening is that I've also gotten involved with some companies where it's affiliate marketing. And then through some of my courses, I've created some high-end products so I can offer them as an affiliate program. And in offering them as an affiliate program, then that's allowed me to have a sales force of people who actually can go out and sell my products, and then they earn commission on it. But let me quickly lay it out for you so you can understand exactly how I say it so that it'll work. And what I've also been able to do is I've been able to go on summits for other companies and be a presenter. Now, here's how I would say it. If I'm talking to someone who wants to learn how to build a business online, and I would say entrepreneurs hire me to recession-proof their business and increase their bottom line by assisting them to build an e-commerce store to establish multiple streams of income because they're intimidated when it comes to incorporating technology into their business. They fear losing sustainable income, and they don't know how to incorporate social media into their marketing plan. So bottom line, I can help someone launch, grow, and expand a home-based business. Now, if I'm talking to someone on the personal development side, I would say I'm a career and personal development strategy coach, and entrepreneurs who are in search of personal development and learning success strategies hire me to overcome their limiting beliefs and develop healthy habits, a successful mindset, and smart goals. So bottom line, I can help you develop a more positive attitude set achievable goals, and make better choices in life.
And that is certainly a good way to put it. And it is about helping people to improve. And of course, that's what we all want to do. How have you helped the disability community in general through what you've done? How do you feel you've had an effect on the community?
When I lived in Atlanta, I was very active with the Access Group, and I was also very active with the DivTACs. And when the Paralympics was, or rather, let's back up. When the Atlanta IOC wanted to bid for the Olympics, at that time, the Olympics and the Paralympics were actually bid for separately. And they bid for the Olympics and they refused to bid for the Paralympics. So it was the disability community that got together and bid for the Paralympics and brought it to Atlanta. And then the head of the IOC at the time basically went in and changed the bylaws so that any host country who bids for one is automatically bidding for both. So they're no, since 1996, they have not been bid for separately. They've been bid for as one unit. And another thing that I did was whenever whenever they would put on job fairs for people with disabilities, I was a volunteer with them and would work with someone that was blind to take them around to the tables so they can interview for positions.
And it makes sense that the Olympics should be handled that way and that there should be emphasis put on it in the same way that the Olympics is portrayed. Do you think that there is room for people in Paralympics, at least to some degree, to be able to be encouraged or to be able to take more of a part in the standard Olympics rather than being, if you will, put in the Paralympics environment? Or do you think that they're so different that they really have to be separate?
I think really they should very much be interconnected. And it's like, in fact, the South African runner who had competed in the Olympics, competed in the Paralympics, he competed in the Olympics one year. Didn't do very well, but he did at least compete. And since then, he accidentally killed someone and is spending time in jail. Well, I cannot remember his name.
Well, I asked the question because I have a friend who was an acclaimed international rowing competitor, and she participated in the Paralympics. And I've never asked her or discussed why they didn't just be part of the actual Olympics and rowing teams and so on. And it just seems to me that there are certainly a number of people who ought to be able to be part of the regular Olympics. Regular is the wrong term, the Olympics as opposed to the Paralympics.
They should, but it still falls back on how society looks at people with disabilities.
There you go. And that's the problem, isn't it?
There's no reason why they cannot be interconnected. And when the media covers Olympic competitions, that they also compete, or they show people with disabilities competing. Because think about it. In the Winter Olympics, you have, snowboarding? In the Paralympics, you have snowboarding. The difference is in the Paralympics, you may have someone doing it with one leg, and they can still compete at the same level as people in the Olympics. But here's the thing: how many times when people think of the Paralympics, they get it interchanged with Special Olympics. But think about it, because in Special Olympics, everyone gets a medal. But in the Paralympics, they medal basically very similar in the way that people in the Olympics get medal. You know, first, second, and third place.
And how often do the Paralympics get the same amount of media, television coverage, and so on as the Olympics?
Actually, people don't even know that it even exists, because we just had the Winter Olympics, and everyone knew when the Olympics was on, but no one knew that a month later, 3 weeks later, the Paralympics started, because the media, the sports, does not cover it in the same way.
How many of the events in the Paralympics actually show levels of competition and numbers at the end of events that are pretty much the same? Well, no, are the same as what you would see in, say, the Winter Olympics this past February. What I'm getting at is the Paralympics, people compete, as you said, in snowboarding. The Paralympics have a number of events that are equivalent to like what we had with the Winter Olympics. Are the results pretty similar in terms of times or whatever we use to measure who wins?
I think so. I mean, if they're competing against the boards in gymnastics and skiing and all the same types of events, and if people would see the level at which someone with a disability is able to compete, then maybe it might change some of their attitudes. Now, think about it. Prince Harry in the United States, you have the Warrior Project, right? And they have Olympic style competitions. Now, Prince Harry started, the Invictus Games.
Right.
And it's still the same thing. You still have wheelchair basketball. You still have the exact, you know, in the Summer Olympics, whereas you have basketball in the Olympics, you got wheelchair basketball.
How possible would it be for wheelchair basketball players to compete on the same court at the same time with people who don't use chairs?
You know,
I don't know. So,
well, that's just it. You know, it. I don't think they ever really tried it.
Right, I understand that.
It seemed to me that if they tried it, it might show just how athletic someone is who's in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. In Atlanta, we have what's known as the Peachtree and a road race, which is a 6K. A 10K. And before the runners start, you've got the wheelchair racers, and they go first. And they will post what their time is. And then you've got the runners, and the Peachtree can have as many as 50,000 or more runners.
Right.
And that's usually, it's like you have to get certain accreditations to take part in other events. And the 10K is one of the ones that someone has to take part in other events in order to qualify to participate in the 10K and the Peachtree. So right. Sometimes you will have runners who are from Kenya or from other countries who have participated in the Olympics that actually come to participate in the Peachtree Road Race. And they're usually the elite runners. And they're usually the ones that win. They're not just the everyday runner that participates.
Right. Well, okay, but if those are the standards, they are. Now, the question is, would a person in a chair running the race have a better or worse time on average, or can they be as competitive, equivalently speaking, as the elite
they're
runners?
They're very competitive. If you've ever seen some of those chairs they use, they're racing chairs, and they really could go up to high speeds in those chairs. I think their time is even better than some of the elite runners who compete in the Peachtree.
What I'm getting at basically is, does one runner have an advantage over another? Does a wheelchair runner have an advantage over the elite runners, if you will? Or can they be, and do you think they should be viewed as equivalent?
I think if they were as one in a race, they would win because those wheelchairs are racers and they can go up to high speed.
So somebody could argue that a runner is at a disadvantage.
Yeah.
Interesting argument. Well, mm-hmm. Where do you see yourself in the next few years?
Well, probably retired.
Good for you. It happens sometime.
I see myself, what I'm working towards is to have built up an extended extra income to supplement what I'm currently getting in. Mm-hmm. So I can live a lot more comfortably.
There you are. Well, let me ask you this. If people want to contact you and reach out to you and take advantage of your services or get to know you better or take your courses, what are the ways to do that?
Okay. They can go. I've got two websites that are membership sites. One is askthevitashinsky.com. The other one is businessblueprintnetwork.com. And also they can contact me by sending an email to info@onepersonalcareercoach.com. And if they want to learn more about the types of services that I offer, as well as my courses, they can go to onepersonalcareercoach.com. And it is the number one, not the spelled out.
So let's go through those again. So if they want your courses, where do they go?
They go to my one on personal development is askdavidashimsky.com.
And spell Davidashimsky, if you would, please.
It's DAVIDASHENSKY.
So
it's
ask
David with an A.
Right.
And I have more people that will drop the A and call me David because of the spelling.
So askdavidashinsky.com.
Yes.
And then what's the next one again?
Okay. Actually, my main website is onepersonalcareercoach.com.
Do that once more.
That's my main website, and that gives them information on my services, on the types of courses I offer, on the types of coaching I offer, and what the prices are.
And say that website once more.
One is the number one, personalcareercoach.com.
Onepersonalcareercoach.com. Okay. Well, I hope people will reach out. I think you bring a very interesting and positive orientation to all of this. And I believe that you offer a really good perspective that people should learn more about. And I believe, as you do, there's a lot of educating to be done. And I really appreciate you being out there and helping in that process, because it is what we need to do.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here and being with us and taking time out of your day. And thank you who are listening to this for taking time to listen and to be a part of Unstoppable Mindset. Please tell your friends about us, and please don't hesitate to review us. We would appreciate a 5-star rating wherever you're getting this podcast from. If you'd like to reach out to me, I hope you will. You can email me at Michael, H-I, M-I-C-H-A-E-L-H-I, at Accessibe, A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E, .com. Love to get your emails and will respond. If you'd like to be a guest, we'd like to hear about that too. As Davida will tell you, we do engage and we will respond to emails, right?
Yes, you do.
And if you'd like to learn more about the podcast, please visit www.michaelhingson.com. That's michaelhingson.com/podcast. So again, thank you all for listening. And thank you, Davida, for being here today.
Thank you. You have a nice day.
You too, and all of you out there as well. And join us again next week for the next episode of Unstoppable Mindset.
You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled M-I-C-H-A-E-L-H-I-N-G-S-O-N. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibe, and is sponsored by Accessibe. Please visit www.accessibe.com. Accessibe is spelled A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.